welcome to this midweek Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we begin with a conversation both urgent and deeply personal. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and clinical psychologist Dr. Alexandra Kohlhaas joins us to talk about why suicide remains such a serious concern in North Dakota, and how this year's theme, Start the Conversation, Be the Difference, can guide us, and what each of us can do to listen, respond, and support those in crisis. Later, we lighten things up a bit with Prairie Plates, a preview of Fargo's 11th annual Drecker Fest. But we'll end the show today again on a serious note, talking about opioids and the role of Narcan in the fight against overdoses. Main Street begins today talking about suicide. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. It's a time to confront the difficult truth that suicide remains one of the leading causes of death in our state and across the country. Joining me again is Dr. Alexandra Kohlhaas. She's a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health. We'll discuss how each of us can play a role in prevention. Certainly, if you or someone you know is struggling, please call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, now. You are not alone, and support is available. This year, Essentia Health is emphasizing the theme, Start the Conversation, Be the Difference. Dr. Kohlhaas, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
Let's start with the big picture. To what extent is suicide a problem here in North Dakota, and why are we seeing such high numbers in our state compared to the rest of the country?
You know, North Dakota has one of the highest suicide rates in the whole country, and certainly this is an epidemic nationwide, but I think here in North Dakota, I believe current statistics are about 23 out of every 100,000 people end up dying by suicide, which is a staggering number. That's about 77% higher than the national average. I think there are a lot of different factors that play into this. One of them is simply just how rural the state is. So when we think about access to resources and we think about loneliness and isolation being huge driving factors for severe depression, North Dakota checks both of those boxes. You know, one of the populations that struggles with the highest rate of completed suicide is the Native American population. And I think that that is a factor too, because we have a lot of reservations in the area. And certainly that's a marginalized group that really struggles with a lot of mental health issues and inadequate resources for treatment.
Have numbers changed in recent years? Have they gotten worse? Have they stayed about the same?
You know, I think in general we've seen some dips and some, you know, bettering numbers moving in the right direction. But overall, I would say that, you know, post-pandemic, they've been relatively stable. That was a huge problem as far as really bringing to the surface a lot of latent anxiety and depression that maybe people weren't really talking about. And ever since about 2020, we've just seen things escalate a lot as far as mental health concerns.
You mentioned Native American folks, but veterans, farmers, young people, they're also in this group that we really wish we didn't have to talk about.
Of course. Well, and I think a lot of that, you know, and this is a generalization, but when we think about sort of the culture, the North Dakota culture, the farming culture, a lot of, you know, the healing model that people go by is, you know, you deal with it, you pick yourself up by your bootstraps, and you don't necessarily talk about it, you just power through and get to the other side of it. And I think that societally, you know, it's really a shame when people feel like they can't ask for help without appearing weak or without appearing incompetent. And with veterans too, you know, people who have served, you talk about the impact of trauma on depression, people who have done active duty certainly are at high risk for severe depression and trauma-related symptoms that can often result in suicide if untreated.
Dr. Kohlhaas, as you know, I've dedicated a lot of time talking about this issue for over a decade in various public media roles, and I've heard it before. Yeah, we pick ourselves up by the bootstraps, we want to do this on our own, and you said it again, that hasn't changed. Why?
You know, I think that in certain areas of the country, in certain segments of the population, perhaps we are making a move towards really breaking the stigma. But I think that it's probably the people who maybe are most needing to have these conversations who aren't having them. And, you know, to sum it up in a word, it's probably fear. Fear of judgment, fear of misunderstanding. It's hard to break old habits, and it's hard to sort of go against maybe what was taught and modeled for us as children that frequently stays with us throughout our lifetimes. And I think that there also is just a discomfort. Suicide is a very difficult topic. People don't want to acknowledge that it could happen to a loved one. It could happen to someone close to them. And I think that there is maybe this subconscious drive to, if I don't think about it, if I don't talk about it, maybe I can remain immune from it, which unfortunately just isn't the case. I think today, most of us probably know of someone who has died by suicide. It's becoming increasingly prevalent to have those personal connections.
The theme that you're pressing forward this year is start the conversation, be the difference. What does starting that conversation really look like?
I wonder if just sort of going off of the, if you see something, say something mentality. If somebody looks sad, if they look withdrawn and isolated, if you see a behavioral change, a change in hygiene, a change in habits, ask about it. You know, people may not be ready to admit that they're having suicidal thoughts, or you may not be the person who that they necessarily are going to talk to about that. But if you open the door, it gives implicit permission. Like, I notice that something's up. I see you. It's okay to talk about it and ask for help.
But it's so difficult. Why is it so difficult to have that conversation? It sounds easy. How can I help you? I see you're struggling, but it's not.
Well, and you know, I think maybe people are hesitant to ask the question because they're afraid of the answer. If someone does endorse, yes, I'm feeling suicidal, then what? You know, there's a pressure there. I think people are generally very well-meaning, but if somebody does say, yes, I'm having thoughts about not wanting to be alive, then all of a sudden you've opened this can of worms, and that's really scary.
So what are some safe and supportive ways then we all should think about if we recognize we should start a conversation?
Well, number one, I would say don't feel like you need to have the solution, right? That could inhibit a lot of people from even starting the dialogue. Even simply knowing that and alerting someone who can help, encouraging people, if you have your own story of, hey, I go to therapy, or hey, I started medication, it really helped, that can bridge the gap for people. And offering, maybe people are afraid to go into the emergency department by themselves and ask for help. Maybe they don't have a ride. Something very logistic like that that shows, hey, I'm here for you and I'll help you in whatever way I can go a long way.
We, these days, get this question at the doctor's office. Do you feel safe today? The answer we want to give is yes, but if it isn't, what should I say to my doctor?
Well, and to your point, I think that a helpful question is probably a lot more pointed than that, right? Because are you feeling safe? That can mean so many things, and the vast majority of people probably don't feel safe today, even if they're not having suicidal thoughts. That aside, your doctor, your primary, is often the gateway, right? Let them know. They may not know what to do or how to help, but they have connections, right? They can hook you up with behavioral health. They can send you down to the emergency department, whatever that looks like, but they are very safe, very appropriate in to further services.
Having a conversation I wish I didn't have to have, quite frankly, with Dr. Alexandra Kohlhase. She's a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health. We're talking about suicide. September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. If you or anyone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, call or text 988, and that's a suicide and crisis lifeline. I've heard you say that people often just want to be heard, Dr. Kohlhase. What's the difference between listening to understand and listening to respond?
You know how sometimes when you're having a conversation with someone and it seems like they're just waiting for their chance to speak? That's sort of what occurs to me when you talk about listening to respond. You just want someone to stop talking long enough that you can add your two cents worth. That generally tends to be less helpful, right? If someone is just really wanting to say something, or they're too busy thinking about what it is that they want to say, to really hone in on what you're saying. Listening to understand, to me, that is a much deeper level of empathy. It's not necessarily having a response. It's not having an answer. It's really hearing the emotion behind the word it may be less about what the person is saying, but how they're saying it. If they're saying, I'm fine, but they're visibly in distress, their voice is shaking, they look pale, they can't look you in the eye, they're really not fine. So it's more than just hearing the words, it's also a full body experience, reading body language and really being present in the moment with that person.
Do you know, or do we know collectively what it feels like to share with someone from someone who really needs help that I need help? I've thought about suicide. What do they feel when they tell someone for the first time?
I don't know that that's something that anybody truly understands unless they've been in those shoes. But I do think that it is very possible to have empathy for that person, even if you have never been there. Imagining the shame that comes with that, the guilt perhaps, the fear. I think that one of the common misconceptions is if I voice that I'm feeling suicidal, I'm going to end up locked in the psychiatric hospital, right? So it takes a lot of courage.
And emphasize, that's not the case.
Correct.
There's help available that is not that.
Yes. And I would even argue that most of the time, 9 times out of 10, it's not that. You know, to be able to safety plan and come up with a way to help keep that person safe at home is ideal. Most people don't feel better being hospitalized, right? So we try really hard to send people home. That being said, it's the feelings associated with that admission, the guilt, the shame, the fear, the desperation, the loneliness. And I think human beings can empathize with that.
We've talked briefly about some of the warning signs. Let's go into more detail, if we could, Dr. Kohlhaas. What are some warning signs that we may not have thought about that we maybe should recognize?
The one that I think people generally are surprised to hear is when someone experiences an unexplained improvement in mood. So people are very low, very flat, very withdrawn, and all of a sudden it seems like they're quote unquote better. I think on the surface we want to believe that that's the case, but in fact that can be a huge red flag, because oftentimes people experience a sense of relief or liberation almost if they have made the decision, this is what I'm going to do and I have a plan. And so that is something to really be tuned into if you notice that behavioral change in someone who has been severely depressed.
Would not have thought that at all. If someone sees those signs in a friend or a family member, but they can't bring themselves to have the discussion, so to speak, to have the dialogue, to begin the conversation, next best advice?
If you're able to share that with a trusted family friend of that person and ask them to have the conversation, because to your point, a lot of people don't recognize that. So if this is a child living at home with parents or guardians, if this is a colleague or coworker, people would not necessarily think that. And so bringing it to someone else's attention and asking them to check in on that person is a really good plan.
You also specialize, Dr. Kohlhaas, in trauma, inequities, and systemic barriers. How do those bigger forces show up in suicide prevention work?
So in general, any marginalized group or underserved group is at greater risk for mental health symptoms, crises, and fewer resources. And so I think that whether that is a lack of trust in, you know, the systems at play, you know, people who have been mistreated by the government or by the system, they're less likely probably to go into a hospital or a clinic and ask for help. A lack of trust in a safe space, right? And this could extend to people of color. This could extend to the LGBTQ community. In general, when people have been traumatized and mistreated, it is harder to be vulnerable and ask for help, especially from people we don't know.
What role do schools and workplaces and faith communities play in creating an environment where conversations about suicide are more possible? And I ask that in the context of recent political pressures, maybe, where we don't want to talk about things that set us to be different.
So I think that open dialogue, I think it's the role of teachers, I think it's the role of the librarian, I think it's the role of the school counselor. I think that even saying the word suicide can be very uncomfortable for people. And I think we should dispel the myth that if you talk about suicide, that doesn't mean that you are making it likelier that someone is going to have suicidal thoughts. That simply is not the case, and it's been disproven. So you're not going to plant the seed. If I talk about suicide in health class, some of these kids are going to start thinking about suicide. That's not where suicidal ideation comes from. And I think, again, just alerting kids to signs and symptoms, to warning signs, so that we all can look out for each other, starting at a younger and younger age, because severe depression and suicidal thoughts are afflicting kids younger than ever before.
So unfortunate. Rural communities, and we've talked about this before, the stigma is strong anywhere, but even more amplified perhaps in a small community where everyone knows everyone. There are more services available in larger communities like you and I live in than there are in rural parts of North Dakota. So I guess to make that a question, what strategies then work best in a smaller place where everyone knows everyone to overcome that stigma?
One of the few positives perhaps to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic was the accessibility to telehealth. That has been a huge game changer. And so now, even here in Fargo, Moorhead, we can access patients all the way out, you know, very, very western North Dakota. And that was simply not an option before. You know, that's hours and hours away, and people generally can't take the time off of work or, you know, afford the gas to come all the way across the state for an hour-long appointment. So our web is wider now. We can cast a wider net as far as who all we can help. So that's one thing. I think too, you know, you mentioned schools, and that would be a way to really start the dialogue and change some of the culture in these small towns. It's not going to happen overnight, but if we can raise our next generation of small town inhabitants, right, to be more educated and more vocal about mental health concerns, that will eventually start to change the fabric of the town. Just takes a lot of time.
What does recovery look like for someone who's survived a suicide attempt or who has lived with suicidal thoughts?
So in the immediate aftermath, you know, if someone has harmed themselves in an effort to complete suicide, it probably will include a hospital stay. It might include, you know, medical treatment as well. And then hopefully that person will be involved in long-term outpatient care, usually a combination of medication management and therapy. That tends to be the gold standard, and it may be something that they seek help for the rest of their lives. Unfortunately, depression is not a condition that generally goes away. It can certainly get better. It can go into remission. But people who have depression tend to struggle with it and need to manage it forever.
We've talked about having the conversation when we see something, but what about long-term support? Where can family members and friends learn more about how to best support someone who is trying themselves to recover from the thought of suicide?
I can't overstate the value and benefit of therapy enough. I think that an individual therapy process for family members, a family therapy process perhaps, especially for a child or teenager who's struggling, to bring the family together and talk about triggers and talk about a safety plan, those things can be imperative. And then I also think support groups, there are groups for people who, you know, have been impacted by mental and physical health concerns for their family members. And I think that just knowing that you're not alone, that can reduce some of the shame and the isolation for family members as well.
For someone who's listening who feels hopeless themselves right now, what would you want them to know?
I think that one of the things that I end up talking to people about a lot is the idea of self-forgiveness and self-love. Oftentimes those things really get lost in the noise, or even are the root causes of severe depression. You know, if you are stuck in the past, it's hard to forgive yourself for things that have happened, or if it's hard to envision a future. You know, to realize that if you were thinking about a loved one having the same thoughts, most of us would be the first to say, you deserve so much better. You haven't done anything that can't be forgiven and healed. Things can improve. I want you to stick around for tomorrow, and being able to remind ourselves of the same thing. I think that's really important. If it seems impossible to connect with people and to really feel heard and valued, you haven't met the right people yet. There are people out there who really truly care and who are invested in helping you if you give them the opportunity. And to remember, suicide is final, and it may seem like a bit of an escape in the moment, but it's not a decision that you can take back. And so to recognize that there are people who care about you and that tomorrow can be better, I think is really, really an important thing to hold on to.
We've had several suicide prevention months in my lifetime. The message is the same. But what would be one thing you, Dr. Kohlhase, would want people to know now in September in Suicide Prevention Month?
It sounds so simple, but talk about it. You're not broken. You're not bad for having these thoughts. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not crazy. It's okay. And it's no way to live. You know, things can be better and it takes a lot of courage to ask for help, but the help is there and nobody deserves to feel like life isn't worth living.
Dr. Kohlhase, language. Committed suicide, completed suicide. There's been a difference.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a movement that a lot of people in the mental health field are trying to start or propagate. The use of the phrase complete suicide, even in itself, carries less stigma. So historically, we've talked about committing suicide, but if you think about the scenarios in which people commit a crime or commit a sin, there's a very negative connotation to that. And so, again, for people who are struggling with feelings of shame or feeling like there's something wrong with them, even that little tweak in verbiage can make a big difference to destigmatize it and use less condemning language.
This September, during Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, reminded of this year's theme, Start the Conversation, Be the Difference. Reaching out, listening, and being present can truly save lives if you or someone you know is in crisis. Call or text 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, for immediate help. My thanks again to Dr. Alexandra Kohlhase, a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health, for sharing her insight and expertise today.
Thank you.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 1 from the New World. Performances include Adam Hochstetter's Noir Concerto No. 1 for saxophone and Russ Peterson's Between Two Cultures, September 20th and 21st at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Information at fmsymphony.org.
Still to come on Main Street, a preview of the 11th annual Drecker Fest and opioids and the use of Narcan. That's ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
There's that music we look forward to on Wednesdays. It's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. We're joined today by Mark Bjornstad, one of the owners of Drecker Brewing Company and Brujala. Drecker is celebrating its 11th annual Drecker Fest this weekend. It's a party packed with food vendors, live music, and plenty of craft beer, of course. Mark, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
The 11th Drecker Fest. For folks who haven't been, how would you describe the event and the atmosphere?
Well, if you thought things at Drecker and Brujala were weird on the regular, I'd say we really turn it on and leave no surprises for Drecker Fest. It's this fun, wild kind of carnival day for family, for the whole community, and just a great event.
What was the genesis? How did it start?
We started just celebrating, our anniversary, threw in some music, and every year just kind of added more and more to it. And when we moved out to the current brewery, we had a lot more space. We had this parking lot, and there was one year where we just kind of looked around at each other and challenged ourselves, like, let's pour gas on this fire. Let's make this the coolest event we can think of and just have a blast.
Rick, I have to believe this is one of your favorites.
This is a really good event. I've been to it multiple times. The concerts are great. The food is great. The thing about Drecker and Brujala is they do everything big. It has to be big. It's like being in Texas. It's just an event. It's a community event, and it's just a lot of fun, Craig.
Tell me what people should expect when they walk in the doors.
Sure. So you'll see lots of different things going on. If you get there early, there's going to be a line at the start of the day. People line up for the beer release and for the tattoo list. And then we also do, on Friday and Saturday, we do a golden ticket giveaways. So there'll be 50 given out each day and a bunch of different prizes. But since it's our 11th Dreckerfest, 11 people are going to win free beer for a year. So if you come right away, you'll see a line. But don't be worried. It'll be easy to get in the rest of the day. It'll be families, people of all ages. It's the whole community there, and it's free for all. That's the whole day. Concert, everything. The wrestling match on Friday night is a ticketed event, but totally worth it.
The tattoo list intrigues me. Tell me what that is.
Yeah, so every year we do we partner with Amarak Tattoos here in Fargo, and they create a flash set, and we create a flash set. So that just being like a kind of a page of tattoos that you can get just that day. So they're smaller, kind of fun theme to the event a little bit. And the really cool thing is that if you want to get the Drecker Viking head, that's on the house. You can get that for free, and it's super fun to see how many people get that every year.
Wasn't that Viking head in beer or in butter at one point? You can't really make a Viking head in beer, I'm sorry, but in butter, excuse me.
I think we did that for one of the hot dish fests. We got it carved into in butter.
And I was at the last two hot dish festivals. I was a judge in the Fargo Hot Dish Festival that Drecker and Brujala does. Is just amazing. You know, speaking of free beer for a year, or just beer in general, talk a little bit about some of these beer collabs that you're going to be doing at Dreckerfest.
Yeah, so this year we've got 11 different collaborating breweries that we made a special beer with. So they're from all over the country. These are friends that we've known for a long time, or met recently. And then it's a really great opportunity for us to like sit down, talk about, you know, inspiration points, ideas, something cool that we want to pull off. Maybe it's a new ingredient that we've just really been wanting to use in a beer, and then find the way to make something creative. So there's four IPAs, all completely different, you know, things from like a triple dry hop double IPA to an all New Zealand hopped single IPA. You know, there's a great mix in there. And then there's four fruited sours. These are all super wild, fun. I think the one that we're really excited about is a Oops All Berries Captain Crunch Cheesecake.
Wow.
Yeah. Beer. It's awesome. It's so wild, and we can't wait for everyone to try it. And then yeah, there's just some really awesome friends that are playing in those mixes too. So, you know, we've got breweries from Florida, Ohio, New York. One of our good friends from Lithuania is jumping in this year. And then also we've got some really special bottles. So we partnered with Microphone out of Chicago and Weldworks out of Greeley, Colorado, two just industry top barrel-aged stout producers and friends of ours. So we came up with two different adjuncted stouts for that. They're amazing. And then with Ology, we worked out a barrel-aged sour, and it's super fun. So fruity, kind of think like tiki cocktail drink.
I never thought I would say Captain Crunch and beer in the same sentence ever in my life. Have you ever really tried something and went, oh my gosh, this just doesn't work?
Well, I mean, for Fooler's Ball, we really push that envelope every year. That's our annual beer festival where, you know, it takes place on April Fool's Day. And so we've done macaroni and cheese and hot dog beer. We've done a Cool Ranch Dorito lager. We did a everything bagel seltzer. We've pushed the envelope out there, and I'd say not all of them were beers that I would want to drink a lot of, but they were exactly what we said they were.
But the creativity flows, so to speak, at Drecker. Well, let's talk about a little bit about the food vendors. I mean, there'll be the normal food vendors in Brujala. They're not normal either. They're very elevated, very good stuff. But some of the food trucks and food stalls.
Yeah, so on top of the things we have in Brujala, like the Bird, Unicorn Park, House of Nudes and Buns, all those places, we're adding a whole nother mix of stuff over in the Drecker parking lot. We've got The Barge and Driftwood. Awesome friends of ours come up from up in northern Minnesota. The Barge is like burgers, chicken strips, wings. Their Nashville hot chicken strips are like my favorite thing ever. That is probably literally what I look forward to the most at Dreckerfest, is getting some of those the food from the Barge. Driftwood's got these awesome, kind of like that Cali style, beach style tacos and
shrimp tacos I've had from Driftwood. Yeah,
awesome stuff. Unicorn Park will be out there with a special Dreckerfest menu. Perfectly Nuts, Treat Theater, and then Scoop and Dough will be there. And I think Scoop and Dough is also doing their cotton candy live for people.
And that's kind of an ice cream.
Yeah, cookie dough thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of the 9 proposed places for a Fargo Convention Center would place a 100,000 square foot center on 27 acres just west of you in the Rail Yard Complex. Is that something that you're excited about?
Absolutely. You know, we see a lot of potential in that neighborhood that we're in out there, and it's a huge opportunity for Fargo to reinvest in a core neighborhood. And what that would create is what's already, you know, slowly started as like kind of an arts and entertainment district out there. And that would put Fargo, you know, on the likes of, you know, like the North Loop in Minneapolis, the Rhino District in Denver, Theodore Street in Phoenix, and create this whole new neighborhood that I think would absolutely transform not just Fargo as a whole, but really see this great neighborhood like come back to life. And so we are very excited about that proposal.
What's this process been like for you as the owner of Brewhalla then, Mark?
Well, we've been kind of spearheading our proposal out there and working to put that together. It's something that we've been working on for almost 2 years. When we started seeing convention center ideas, whether it was, you know, different places in town where the city was talking about doing that, it was kind of floundering for a while. We started to look at it and think, you know, I think we've got an opportunity out here at Brewhalla. We've got a ton of open land. This neighborhood's ripe for redevelopment, and it's, you know, on the doorstep of downtown. Started to just make sense. And so we started putting that project together about 2 years ago and talking to all the other, you know, community members and organizations that are at the table. And that's really what shaped our proposal.
From my standpoint, convention center over by your outfit would really elevate the food scene even more, I think.
It's really cool what we think what would happen with that. And you know, I'll be honest, too. I think Fargo just needs a convention center. It's going to be great wherever they put it. You know, we obviously believe in our proposal, but we're going to be happy wherever this goes, because it's going to be a great thing for Fargo to have this and draw more people into the community and really show off what makes Fargo such a great place to live and to visit.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the Oktoberfest. We're in that season, those Oktoberfest, Fest-style, Marzen-style beers. What do you offer at Drecker?
So we do a Fest beer. It's called Hausterhosen. We say it's a very loose translation. I mean, like fall party pants beer. So kind of get your Lederhosen on and get together and drink a bunch of Fest beers together.
There isn't any Captain Crunch in it.
No Captain Crunch. This is a truly traditional style, you know, done in that German brewing technique. But yeah, ours is a Fest beer style, and that's our preference. You know, we don't not like Marzen's. We just, you know, we got to pick one, and we love Fest beers.
And you as a brewer, you would say that has a heavier roast, right?
A Fest beer is going to be a little lighter.
Lighter.
So a Fest beer is going to be a little bit lighter on the malt side, a little bit crisper and cleaner. It might have a slightly more pronounced hop character, but really what you're going to get off of that is like really beautiful, kind of like toasted biscuit, subtle caramel, but I really like accentuating that like toasty note to it. Where a Marzen style is going to be a little bit more malty, bolder.
Yeah.
It'll be slightly darker. I would say it's not as heavy or big as like a Bock, but, you know, malty, a little bit bigger. I kind of like to think of it as like the way I like to drink, you know, the two beers that fall under the Oktoberfest umbrella is I like Fest beers in like September and early October. And then when it starts to get a little bit colder and we get into that like later October, that's where I like to drink Marzen's. It's got to be a little bit colder for me to drink something that malty.
Looking forward to this event, and there's also some wrestling going on.
Yeah, so Friday night we've got Time Bomb coming up doing their just amazing, weird, wild wrestling show on Friday night.
And then Saturday, there's music.
Saturday night, we've got Motion City Soundtrack kicking off the night. It's a free concert. Everyone's welcome. We're super excited to have them. You know, a band that originates out of Minneapolis, but it seems to have struck a note with all the millennials out there that this is some big flashback music. So we're really excited.
Drekker Fest 11, that's Mark Bjornstedt. He's the co-owner of Drekker Brewing Company and Brewhalla. The dates are September 12th and 13th. That's just this Friday and Saturday. He shared with us what's on tap for the 11th annual Drekker Fest and beyond. Mark, it's been a pleasure having you with us today on Prairie Plates.
Thanks for having me. Hope to see you all at Drekker Fest this weekend.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Craig. We'll talk to you soon.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free family event is October 4th and 5th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, fabric artists, jewelry artists, group studios, and more, all demonstrating their work. Peruse the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
Hey, Prairie Beat fans, I'm Ann Alquist, Director of Radio. I hope you'll join us for the State of the Station, October 2nd, at the Sanctuary Event Center in Fargo. Our special guest is PBS CEO Paula Kerger. More information about tickets at prairiepublic.org. See you there.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. You're probably aware of the opioid crisis that's hit many communities hard, including here in North Dakota. And while the worst of the crisis may have abated in recent years, there are still many of our friends and neighbors who are addicted to these powerful medications. As we'll hear on this week's Prairie Beat, the good news is that effective ways to help overdose victims are becoming more readily available.
Well, howdy ho, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for once again joining us for another episode of Prairie Beat.
Yeah, hopefully by now you know if you come this far. It's our weekly podcast focused on topics making the news in the Prairie region. Danielle, what is on the beat this week?
Well, Eric, later this month on September 21st is National Opioid and Substance Abuse Awareness Day. And before we get into it, can I ask you a personal question?
A personal question? Ooh, I'm a little scared. Well, fire away.
All right. Have you ever been prescribed and taken an opioid?
Well, thinking back, as a matter of fact, my tooth is starting to throb just thinking about it. I had a tooth extracted and I didn't even go under. Man, it was a little bit on the medieval side. It was intense, so I was given some oxycodone afterwards for the pain.
Yeah, so I've taken them too, actually. So both my kids were born via C-section, and that sucked. So I was given oxycodone for my recoveries for those. And honestly, you know, I think if you ask around, you're probably going to encounter a lot of people with similar stories. But when I was covering a story this week for the newsroom, I heard a statistic that was pretty alarming. One in four people who are prescribed an opioid for pain will struggle with addiction.
Gosh, that's a really daunting statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gosh, Danielle, between me and you and many others, we both may know somebody who has gone through some similar things. I mean, I know somebody in my orbit that passed away from an opioid overdose. It's kind of like now, you know, COVID, like somebody in your universe probably passed away from COVID. So it's all hitting a little bit too close to home for my taste anyway. Although, given what we know about how opioids were initially marketed and came on the scene, Sacklers looking at you, I guess we shouldn't be too shocked.
We don't have a ton of time to get into the, you know, the whole history of it all, but just to bring anybody up to quick speed, basically because of the opioid crisis, manufacturers and distributors settled lawsuits and had to agree to pay states billions of dollars for a pretty long time to try and course correct the damage that was done. North Dakota is one of those states, and what we did here was we established the State Opioid Settlement Fund, which is used by state and local entities to run addiction treatment and prevention efforts.
Yep, that's all sounding very, very familiar.
This week, I got to talk to someone who works in that field.
Robin Litke-Sal, Prevention Coordinator at Fargo Cass Public Health.
Robin Litke-Sal conducts free naloxone, also known as Narcan, courses in the Cass County area. That's the drug that can reverse an opioid overdose. The classes are free, they're short and pretty comprehensive, and they're available to anybody who wants to take them.
Yeah, okay, so I've heard of that. That naloxone, or Narcan as it's known too, that's pretty widely available, I would hope. Is that correct?
That is. So because of the opioid settlement and how the state disperses it, public health units are able to get what they need and give it out at various places. Leaky Cell says they give it to the harm reduction centers. Fire departments like to take them. They're available for free at public health units. They're available over the counter at many pharmacies. And the naloxone courses she teaches instructs how to administer the drug. It's kind of like a nasal spray. She goes into certain risk factors for overdose and then recognizing the signs and symptoms of overdose as well. And Leaky Cell works in Cass County specifically, so that's one area of the state. But this is something that's available statewide because of that settlement, again, through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. You can actually go online and look at their website where it shows all the different agencies that were awarded grant money from this opioid settlement in the current biennium. And, you know, these programs and these drugs, they work. Leaky Cell said last year, naloxone was administered 450 times alone at the Harm Reduction Center. And just last month, North Dakota Health and Human Services reported that between June of last year and June of this year, more than 33,000 naloxone kits were distributed statewide, with over 870 overdose reversals reported. They also said overdose deaths dropped 22% statewide between 2022 and 2024. So it's making a big impact.
That's absolutely astonishing to think about, Danielle. I mean, when you said 450 times alone, naloxone was administered in the state of North Dakota. So that's, you know, obviously more than one a day, something like this happens. And so I'm just wondering, like, how people can get naloxone. You said the website. So, I mean, like, can I just, like, as a good Samaritan who wants to wear my Superman cape and save some people, can I just, like, have a belt full of naloxone and just walk around the street
if you wanted
and save
to.
Some folks? I mean, is, yes. is that how, with the settlement, that's
yes.
how it works?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay. So you too could be Superman. So, Danielle, we both talked about how each of us has been prescribed opioids for legitimate medical reasons, things that we went through, surgeries, in your case.
Cesarean.
The C-section, and me with my teeth. Obviously, there's a risk factor for addiction. And even though we know by now that opioids are highly addictive, I know there is usually more to the story there, too. What are other risk factors for opioid addiction and overdose?
Leaky Cell spoke about that quite a bit as well. For those at risk for overdose, it could include people who accidentally or purposely take too much of their prescribed opioid. There's people who maybe take someone else's drugs. Mm. Others who inject or snort opioids. That can kind of affect, you know, how it works on your body. Or you combine them with other substances like alcohol or other substances that slow down the central nervous system too. And then she explained that in her work, they tend to focus on individuals who have recently been released from incarceration or drug treatment programs because they are at a particularly high risk.
And the reason for that is that anyone that has an opioid use disorder that has a period of non-use and then goes back to use is going to be at a very high risk for overdose because that period of non-use leads to a change in their tolerance. So they no longer know how much is too much for overdose.
She also said that every addiction story is different. It can also include teens who may have had dental work like you did, mm-hmm. or even sports injuries. Once that prescription runs out, if someone's addicted, they may end up looking elsewhere.
Yeah, on the street or however they, mm-hmm. Dark web, whatever. Given how much has been learned about opioids and how addicting they can be, I'd have to imagine that doctors are a little more careful when they give out those prescriptions these days, right?
Yes, Leaky Cell did mention that. And I can say just anecdotally in my own experience, I feel like that was true for me as well. When my first son was born in 2019, I was given a full bottle of oxycodone for that pain I was in after that C-section. They gave me the information warnings and, you know, all the addiction overdose stuff. But they also told me to take the pills as long as I felt that I needed them. And the next time I had a C-section, which was just a couple years ago now, it was different. They only gave me 3 days worth of pills along with that warning packet with all the information in it about addiction and overdose and death. And Leaky Cell also said in many instances, you can even ask your doctor for something else if you don't want to take opioids.
You simply can deny opioids. There are other pain relievers that are equally or even more effective at relieving pain than opioids. So if you're concerned at all, and you know, 25% odds, everyone really should be concerned, is to discuss that with your doctor and you'd be very informed of it. And you have the right to request that you use something else, that you are prescribed something else that can help so you don't have that risk of addiction with opioids.
Well, that is very empowering to hear. You know, I can recall back in the days, and this does coincide with drug companies and their just relentless marketing efforts mm-hmm. towards doctors, hospitals, institutions, whatever, when they literally were being prescribed like candy. So it's a little bit different now. Deep down, I know we can speak up and advocate for ourselves in our healthcare, but it could be a little intimidating in the moment if a doctor says, hey, this is a drug you should take for that pain. I think that sometimes they're thinking differently about pain treatment now. It was, you mm-hmm. know, during the whole crisis, it was pain, 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 must treat pain. I wonder if that's a little bit different now. Hopefully hearing that will give people a little more confidence to speak up for themselves if they have concerns about taking an opioid.
One last thing she said I thought was important was that we shouldn't pay attention to the stigma surrounding opioid abuse and overdose. She says applying stigma to it just makes things worse.
We just really need to be empathetic, lower the stigma, not think of it as those people, and because it does hit everyone in every race, creed, color, socioeconomic status. It could be your neighbor, your friend, a loved one. It really does affect a large swath of the community. It's not just those people.
Indeed. Understanding that opioid addiction doesn't just happen to quote-unquote other people and could in fact affect our own households, and for many of us it sure has. I think that awareness alone can certainly go a long way. Destigmatizing is kind of a big part of this story. I also think it's empowering to know that these life-saving resources are available and easily accessible in our communities. Danielle, thank you for all that. It's a very important topic. It's touched us all, I think, in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do that all important, the word of about 2 years ago, pivoting. Remember that? Everybody said pivot all the time. So what else have you, Dave and Ty, been working on in the Prairie Public Newsroom?
I would estimate hundreds of thousands of animals have been through pet rescues in North Dakota over decades.
Well, last week I wrote a story about North Dakota Raise for Rescues. It's a fundraising and awareness campaign for pet rescues in the state. It's all done online and wraps up at the end of this weekend.
There's a lot of crews out there working, making a push, you know, at the end of the construction season here to get these projects wrapped up.
North Dakota's road construction season has gone well. This year's budget was about $400 million. Some larger projects will continue into next year.
No dinosaurs. Instead, we're looking at, like, fish and turtles and the big sea reptiles like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs.
And I loved Dave's story about this year's public fossil digs by the North Dakota Geological Survey. They had about 230 people sign up for these digs around the state. And they were working on sites where they unearthed a lot of oceanic-type fossils. They're now working on figuring out what digs to do next year.
Well, another week, another thought-provoking and thorough episode. At least we hope you think so, of Prairie Beat. You're the one that counts, obviously. Hey, thanks a lot for listening. Danielle, thank you.
Absolutely, you bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news from the Prairie Public Newsroom, or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
We drop Prairie Beat, our regional news podcast, every Wednesday. You can listen on your own time at prairiepublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 10th. Cattle flourished on the excellent grazing lands of Western Dakota Territory in the 19th century. Massive herds roamed freely across the plains. Ranches began springing up in the Badlands before North Dakota was even a state. The most famous was Teddy Roosevelt's Maltese Cross Ranch, but there were many more. Some folded after just a few years, while others managed to hang on and become prosperous. Before barbed wire, keeping track of those loose cattle on the open range was a real challenge. Herds from different ranches often mixed together. That's when Western ranchers adopted branding to identify their cattle, a practice made famous by the cowboys of the Old West. Many ranches were named for nearby landmarks, places like Sloping Bottom, the Badlands Cattle Company, the Oxbow Ranch, owned by the Marquis de Moores. Others took their names from the brand itself, like the Maltese Cross or the Long X. On this date in 1909, the Golden Valley Chronicle announced the sale of a very prosperous Billings County ranch to an experienced horseman from Dickinson. The Q Bar Ranch, located at the head of Magpie Creek, got its name from its well-known brand, which was a Q with a straight line underneath. The property included 200 head of horses, a comfortable ranch house, a barn, and a summer camp for ranch hands in the Badlands. Buyer Bert Townsend said he was putting up a large amount of hay in preparation for winter. He also believed the ranch could support up to 500 horses and planned to expand his stock in the coming year. Townsend was described as a skilled horseman, and the paper predicted he'd improve the region's breeding stock. Ranching is still alive in the Badlands. Cattle are still home on the range, but things have changed. These days, many ranches offer visitors a chance to stay on a working cattle operation. Activities include riding the range alongside real working cowboys. Visitors won't spend 12 hours a day in the saddle in all kinds of weather, but they will get a glimpse of what life was like on the old cattle ranches. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Difficult conversations today, but we are glad that you've joined us. The conversation doesn't get much easier tomorrow as we visit with Amy Britz and Kayla Jones. They're our guests from the North Dakota Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition. We'll work through how widespread the problem is in our state, and it's a big problem, but there's help available, and we'll talk about that too. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.